back with the Geek Whispers. This is Matt Brender.
And I'm John Mark Troyer.
And I'm Amy Lewis.
And we are pleased and honored to have a regular listener join us for the first time. And Susan, could you introduce yourself?
I'm Susan Fogarty. I'm the editor-in-chief of Network Computing, which is an online magazine, soon to be community. And I'm very happy to be here, and I'm honored to be a guest at the Geek Whisperers. I just recently discovered the podcast, and I was so pleased to find that there are other Geek Whisperers out there.
Oh, I'm so glad that's becoming a metric or like a thing. We have Geek Whisperers in
metric,
the world.
Yeah.
I actually think it's a warning.
Why is? But do tell. What's the warning label on us?
I just found your podcast, and somehow I wound up here.
Yeah, be careful who you tweet at. Susan tweeted at us a couple of weeks ago and said she was enjoying the podcast, so I immediately invited her on. Well, Susan, I just think that shows you have good taste.
I agree. And Susan, just to continue to break the ice, because I don't know you as well as I like to before I start heckling a fellow Geek Whisperer. So could you tell us just one random fact about you? It does not have to be about technology. Just who is Susan?
I hate feet and clowns, and I like to sing.
Oh my God, I think I love you.
That works for me. Hey, Matt, I'd like to ask Susan, I mean, tell us a little bit, this isn't a commercial for network computing at all, but I imagine we'll refer back to it a little bit as we talk about interesting things you're working on or doing. How long have you been with UBM and network computing, and kind of can you give us the one sentence pitch for what network computing covers?
Sure. So I have actually only been with network computing since November.
Oh, wow.
But I've been covering networking and IT infrastructure for 18 years now. I started Penwell Publishing back in 1996, and then I was there for about 5 years, and then I moved over to TechTarget. And you may know TechTarget, and I was in the networking media group there for 11 years.
Okay.
And then I did a brief stint at Dell in their marketing department. And
so you've seen both sides of the abyss then.
And I kind of bounced around a little bit in UBM, and then they needed someone to take over network computing, and they said, oh, well, Susan knows about networking. Let's put her there. So I'm happily ensconced now at Network Computing.
That's
and
wonderful.
We cover not just networking, but infrastructure, the whole, with your backgrounds, you are aware that, you know, everything is kind of converging onto this big platform. So we cover virtualization and data centers and storage some unified communications and cloud as well.
Never heard of any of those things. Never heard of any of those things. Nothing. Not familiar with that. One thing that I was impressed with about Susan, I'm not a particularly regular reader, but I occasionally swing by, is that as we were researching for the show, I do notice that actually you have hired friends of ours like Howard Marks, Ethan Banks, Greg Farrow, Joe Onosik, to do some writing for you, and we'll get into that. But I think that shows again you have very good taste.
Ha, agreed.
Thank you.
And I think John really framed this quite well as we were discussing before the show that we're approaching kind of a brave new world out there. And when we look behind us at the old republic, this sort of golden age where media was consumed by a single, you know, Bible of information that landed on your doorstep once a month and you actually picked up the book and read it versus this very strange distributed model that's in front of us. Back then, there's just clear gatekeepers. There's clear sort of a sense of ownership by, you know, organizations like the one you recently joined in network computing. And we wanted to really discuss that with you, discuss some of the facets of where we've been, where we're going, and what it means to be an influencer with this new organization. So, Amy, you know, you have a lot of opinions on this. What are you feeling?
Oh, I do. I was going to say, pick me. So for those of you who don't know, I actually come from traditional publishing, as in books. made of trees. And
like
even
cavemen.
Though, I know. I scratched
You're the one that killed
the
them.
I actually faxed a lot in my first job in the mailroom. True story. So, Susan, I am so excited to be able to talk to you and find out, you know, I left publishing 5 or 6 years ago to move over into technology, at which point I have more deadlines and more content creation responsibilities than I did before I left publishing. So what do you see as the state of the state? Just put it out there. Can any of us get paid for our intellectual property anymore? Is the concept of writing and journalism and being paid for that dead?
It's funny that you bring that up. I don't think, I hope not, is my gut feeling. I don't think so, but I do think that there is definitely a democratization of information going on, and that, you know, there is no longer this beacon on the hill that sends out all of the information. Everybody has the same access to information now, but there is a role for the media that's now rather to, instead of sending all of that information out to people, it's more to distill it down and whittle it down into what is really important for people to need to know. And, you know, so I sort of see myself as more of an organizer of that information and of people and of resources to give my audience the really important stuff that is essential for them to do their jobs. And it's funny that we're talking about who my competitors are, and I don't even see them anymore as who traditionally were the competitive magazines out there. More and more, they are the people who used to just be my readers, the people that you were just mentioning who now write for me, and used to just read the magazine. They are also bloggers, and they might write for me, but they're also my competition. So it's a really strange dynamic Ooh. Going on, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
And in traditional publishing, it became where you had to do, you know, your day job, your writing that you were paid for.
Mm-hmm, yep.
And then you also had to do innumerable bits of extra writing, you know, trailer bits, things for the jacket, things for blogs, things for social media. Like, you had a whole other writing career, which I think writers and content creators understood that they were doing one form that was sort of highly polished, delivered, et cetera. And believe you me, I'm going to take the stand of, you know, most people benefit highly from a good editor. I will always take that stand because I have read things that became New York Times bestsellers in their unedited form. And trust me, that is a necessary transformative layer in many, many cases. I think, you know, I worked in literary publishing. So it was early on, people were seeing having to give away a bit for free to do this other thing on a paid basis. It's interesting that from your model, that happens a bit as well. I would think the giveaways are to build reputation, because you just can't show up and be, you know, a highly valued, insightful tech writer. You can't come out of nowhere. So you have to give away some.
Amy, what do you mean by giveaways?
Meaning, like, issues, as Susan was saying, like, if her writers are also her competition. So maybe you're a blogger, and sometimes you write a paid article, but sometimes you write for free on your own blog. And you need both, but then there's competition for eyes.
Got it.
I think it is coming back around that for a while, when the economy was doing better, there were bloggers who were making a decent amount of money from tech publishing, and they were in high demand because all of a sudden people recognized that, oh, you know, these guys were really smart. They had a lot of knowledge that you couldn't really get anywhere else. But now there are so many of those blogs, and I think, you know, people are catching on that it's these are a really good resource, but it's kind of, they've flooded the market. There's so many of them and there's so much information out there that I think that, that these bloggers won't actually be able to command the kind of money that they have in the past, at least in my, you know, the, in the subject matter areas where I work.
Well, then the question becomes, does that that creates value all over again for a curatorial or editorial process? Is that something you found to be true, where the ability to synthesize, the way to screen and absorb the information? Because we've talked a lot about content glut. So mm-hmm. are you finding that that role becomes heightened again, that maybe the you know, free market economy, like the amount of supply is so overwhelmed demand that the cost has dropped, but then we'll have to have a model for consumption that will have to change?
Well, that's what I'm seeing, that I'm predicting is going to happen. That's from my point of view. The bloggers that I talk to don't actually really agree with me on that yet, I don't think. But that's
no
sort
listening.
Of my long view.
you can tell me. No one can hear us.
Right.
Bloggers don't listen to our podcast.
This is multiplied or taking place in the context of, you know, the overall media landscape, right? Where, you know, the exactly. cliche is that you know, paper offline dollars are turning into digital pennies. Display ads are going down. The price for display ads are going down and down and down. You know, and that's in the mainstream media. And we're in this other little highly specialized thing where we certainly can't go on volume, right? Because there ain't that many IT people out there compared to the New York Times. And so you definitely have some economic shifts going on altogether. And that obviously the publishing companies, like you work for Susan, are already, you know, they you do a lot more than just display ads for the advertisers, right? What I loved what you said though about explaining, again, mirrored in is what I love, that that's also going on in the mainstream media. We see people like 538, what's his name, Silver, leaving the New York Times and forming his own thing. Ezra Klein leaving the Washington Post, doing his own thing. The Pierre Omidyar startup, you know, doing the, and that those are no longer journalistic outfits that are dedicated to explaining the news of the day. Those are journalistic outfits that are giving context. And in some ways, I feel like it's the, you know, over at Enterprise Tech Press, we've been doing that all along. And you've been doing that all along, Susan.
I have to jump in here with one quick observation. You have to pay homage to where you came from. And in every single case, I think there is still, and again, this speaks to my traditional book publishing roots, but there is still great weight carried by the fact that you wrote for the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, etc. That you wrote for traditional press and media gives you a level of gravitas, that you went through the editorial process, that your work was deemed worthy. That's still something people put in their bios and use as a mark of credibility.
And I think writing for a magazine also, you get treated differently at VMware if you write for a magazine than if you write for just on your own blog.
No. And I guess the point I'm trying to bring up there is, I think that's interesting because I completely agree the model is shifting, but we are caught in between those models because we still have great reverence, I think, for the traditional because it carries weight. But we want the model to change. And again, I'm going to shut up and let Susan talk more about this. I think I want to hear more about the different angles, what that looks like from different perspectives.
Was there a question?
Yeah.
Yes. So what that shifting model looks like, again, if we take the assumption that we do have some reverence for that old school, but to your point, John, all the shifts, what that looks like from the eye of an editor versus the eye of a writer versus the eye of a reader.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, we have a lot of very experienced people where I work, editors where I work, and there's a very wide range of how accepting they are in the transitions that we are making. Like, I like change and I like to do things differently and I don't mind experimenting with things. So I'm all for, you know, getting on social media, putting comments into our articles or whatever it is that we want to do, hiring new people. But a lot of the old school reporters, they don't really want to veer from the strategy. And that creates a lot of, you know, a lot of conflict at times. But I think our company in general really wants to move ahead with doing less like straight reporting, a lot more curated content, a lot more community-based events and content that doesn't necessarily require the same skills, but they still want these really experienced people to do them. Interesting. And I'm not sure how that's going to actually work out because you know, it's sort of an attitudinal thing, but it's also a skills-based thing too, because I don't know that you really do you need someone with 20 years of editorial experience, you know, writing like catchy headlines to put something in BuzzFeed. I don't necessarily think that you need that. And the people who have that experience might not want to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Susan,
so that creates a problem.
Am I hearing, just taking a step back for a second, I've just kind of been observing as I absorb the different angles of this, but it sounds like we're in, I mean, we all knew this going into it, but we're really in a time of flux where there's both this historical respect for those that have the sort of, you know, official credentials that they're a made man or woman and have been published, quote unquote. Yet we still have this other sense of the matter, which is that there's democratization and everyone can show up and anyone can just Google and get pretty good at things and start making a great blog. And we don't quite know where that leaves those with really high trained skills that aren't willing to kind of lower themselves as others are raising up their skill set. Is that a fair assessment or am I missing a couple details?
That's true. I think it is much more democratic, you know, and the internet kind of makes everyone gives you the same playing field for everyone. And it just changes a lot.
I have a question about the kind of the role of a newspaper, of a magazine. I was at a community manager conference recently and happened to be sitting by a gentleman named Todd Lappin. He was a writer and perhaps an editor at Wired magazine back in the day. And actually, I remember him only because back in the day, he has a van that has he's got a van down by the river. No, he's got a van that has a logo on it that says Telstar Logistics. And so he can park anywhere in the city and not get a ticket.
Oh,
brilliant man.
Smart.
But he now works for Flipboard. And we were at this community manager conference. So you can kind of imagine what was coming next. We were talking about the nature of magazines. And he said he let off something that could have come out of my mouth, which was a magazine is basically I don't remember exactly how he put it. But basically the magazine is a community. The magazine is the instantiation and talking to a set of people who are interested in what the magazine is talking about. So it's not like the magazine is the oracle. Broadcasting, it is the magazine actually consists of its readers who are a community interested in what the magazine is talking about. Susan, how does that play into how you're seeing media and your efforts evolving?
That's interesting. I would not say that a magazine is a community. I think for a community to exist that the community members have to actually give something back. So
I think actually you're right. But definitely there seems like there's more community elements. We talked about comments and things like that. It
sure
seems like we've got to have more community elements. I don't know if they think of themselves as – I mean maybe they do think of themselves as members of a community. I don't know. But definitely it seems like more community elements are necessary.
Sure. I mean maybe in the old days when you got a magazine and you waited for it to come and then you read it cover to cover, then that's – you know, you were a part of a community. But – you know, we're actually relaunching our site at the end of April on a new platform that makes it a lot easier to comment. And we're going to have more actually kind of radio shows that are like this podcast and live chats. And we're inviting a lot of new people to contribute blogs so that we will have a lot more interaction going on. And we hope that that will allow more people to feel like they're part of a community rather than that we are just throwing content at them and they are the consumer of the content.
Mm-hmm. I have to jump in and ask again, sort of the corollary to the question we started with, for those content creators, can they make a living at this? Can you do this as a craft?
I think for some of them, I think there are going to be, you know, like tiers of them, mm-hmm. honestly. Yeah. We will, you know, have some people on staff and then maybe a few select people that we pay and then kind of the masses that
the don't quit your day job masses.
Yeah. Or, you know, just kind of people who come by once in a while or, you know, when they have free time and they're not coming every day to contribute something, but they do when they can and they're more of a casual contributor to the community.
Sure. That makes a lot of sense.
And I'm curious how, and I know, Matt, you're going to get into this. Matt is our resident numbers person. I can feel him chomping at the bit. Like, how this gets measured, what this looks like, what the numbers are, what are we talking? What's that revenue model look like? Is it about ad revenue? Is it about you pay for certain bylines if they are of a certain quality or certain research papers? Wait a minute,
Amy. Are you talking about how does a contributor make money, mm-hmm. which is usually per piece for a lot of the freelancers, or are you talking about how the magazine makes money?
Both. So both how – again, how the – exactly both.
Well, I know that we at UBM, we are actually creating new metrics around engagement. So – We have measured performance of the websites in page views, and we're getting away from that to some degree. We are going to be measuring engagement, and they're still defining these, so I'm not 100% clear on how exactly they will measure it, but they're coming up with an algorithm that combines comments with return visits and registrations, mm-hmm. and time spent on site and those kinds of things, to try to get really to understand how long people are spending and what they're doing on the site rather than if people are just, you know, like hit and runs from Google.
I mean, that's the easiest thing to measure, right? It's easy to sell packages based on, all right, I'll give you 1,000 hits at least, so we'll make sure at least 1,000 people see this, because that's always been like the 1-to-1 ratio. But no one's surprised that in the easily distracted and complex consumption models that we have today, that that's just not how data should be measured. It's a vanity metric as opposed to anything meaningful about your business. Sounds like you're trying to really start adopting some principles of inbound marketing and how to measure whether or not the information you're putting out there is engaged by your audience. So it sounds quite interesting, actually. I'm a little worried about algorithms made behind closed doors as opposed to adopting standards to industries. To be quite honest, but
well, there's their internal metrics and there's, you know, how they're representing to the advertisers.
Yeah, but we've all have been part of big companies, and when people have the ability to define what good looks like and like what success is versus failure, I would bet heavily that somebody will choose that success looks like what they're getting and failure looks like something that they're not getting. So I'm always a little skeptical of any numbers made without them being like publicly discussed or adopted by an industry.
That's true. Although I think that they have best intentions and that this just doesn't really exist yet, what they want to measure. And we will have the raw numbers available, I think.
Well, Well, it's just the best part about metrics is you know they can if you're not careful they can be gamed. So yeah, you're going to be writing like 7 cute kittens that could save your data center.
I hope not.
Although actually, kittens in a data center would be awesome pictures. Do that.
We need more kittens in the data center.
Oh man, I walked into a data center in a Wookiee outfit once. And, man,
just like dressed normally?
I was with Steve Harrod. We were shooting a video. We wanted to shoot a video in the data center. And of course, his key card, because he was a CTO, opened the door. We walked in the data center and the dude in charge ran at us like, oh, because I'm bringing this like hairy, dirty thing into his really clean data center. He almost killed us. So maybe kittens don't belong in the data center. I don't know.
Aww. Well, it's interesting. Thank you for going into that a bit, Susan. I know discussing meaningful metrics especially as you transition from like a blunt object, like look at how many page views I can give you versus a rather refined scalpel of measurement, like, hey, out of the people that show up, how often do they come back and how often do they engage with us? Do they share it with their friends? Like really trying to get the personality of what your content inspires in people. It's a totally different beast. And I look forward to talking to you more probably over DMs about how that's going.
Yeah. I'd really like to know who they are too. I want to know more, you know, like what their background is and what their job titles are and that kind of stuff. And
sure.
I don't know how that's going to go either.
Well, Susan, one of the things that's different about journalism versus, say, analysis is that there's always been some sort of a Chinese wall between editorial and sales. I was talking to an analyst last night, and he was like, yeah, man, people can take me out to dinner all the time. It's not really considered, you know, unethical. They disclose their clients, but, you know, dinner doesn't count. So, but now that being said, we were talking about engagement. Now, are you, as you plan your editorial, are you aware of what the sales team has promised folks in terms of engagement or page views or anything like that? Or can you just, are you just mostly focused on the product, the editorial product?
I do not know anything about what sales has promised as of now. Eventually, I will know what if there are page view guarantees or engagement guarantees. Mm-hmm. And then I might have to do the 7 kittens in the data center thing to bump up something here or there. We are trying to plan everything so that we have kind of realistic goals across the board, and that won't be an issue. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the best laid plans sometimes don't work out. Sure. So I'm not sure exactly how that's going to go yet.
But it sounds like you're taking the right things into account, totally, right? And you know, it's not about page views. It is about who shows up. You do have an audience you're trying to talk to. I don't know. We're all – let's see. Matt's a techie again. He's back building servers. you were in marketing, dude. I've seen you in marketing. Amy, come from publishing, now is a Geek Whisperer. I was a techie, have been in marketing for a while. But so, Susan, as a journalist and an editor, how do you I don't know if this other than how do you keep up with what's going on? How do you know what your readers want to see?
I talk to the readers.
Good answer. So
yeah. I mean, and I do also interact, you know, with the vendors and talk to the technologists at the vendors and get their spiel on what's going on. And that's actually very helpful, you know, so that's how I keep up on all the new stuff coming out. But as far as what the readers want to read about, I, you know, Twitter is godsend for that because I just ping them and they tell me what they want to hear about.
That is a really cool fact of the matter. It's like, hey,
I love that we still have to explain that in 2014. You know, so I'm just sitting here smiling as you say it and knowing that someone will send this podcast to someone and the inevitable stick it in the eye angle of our podcast and say, see, people don't just fritter away their time on Twitter.
It's like, but wait, how will they know what we want them to think if you ask them what they want to think. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it's amazing how listening is a key skill that gets forgotten.
And conferences are very good. You know, yeah. In person can't be beat either.
Without a doubt. So we've talked about metrics. We've talked a good bit about the past and how it's transitioned to the present and whether there are dollar signs associated with it. John, what's your angle on things? What do you care most about?
First thing I noticed at Network Computing is that you guys do have all these featured bloggers, and it's no longer unusual at the trade press, but they are listed very prominently, and I happen to know some of them, so that was unusual to me. They weren't like longtime journalists. They were kind of active technologists that write on the side, freelance. So how is this something that you brought to this particular publication, or how are you looking at bringing in outside writers? How are you approaching that, Susan?
You know, it's funny because I had been working with a lot of those people when I was at TechTarget years and years and years ago, and I didn't lose touch with them, but I wasn't working directly with them anymore because I had kind of come up the ranks and I became more in the management level at TechTarget. So I didn't have a lot of direct contact with them anymore. But I knew, you know, I knew all their names and stuff. And now I'm getting to reconnect with them because they sort of became famous through working at TechTarget. And then all of these other people said, oh, look at these guys, they're so smart, you know, they can really write well. And now I'm getting to reconnect with all of them and discover all of these new people too, that then I had done all of this research and found all these great people. And then I stumbled across Amy's Twitter account and your Geek Whispers podcast and said, oh, if I'd only found this first, you've done all of this work also. And I would have saved myself months of looking for people.
That's only reaffirming my declaration of love earlier in the podcast.
Like, geez.
It's amazing. I just love hearing you explain your methodology because it has more credibility when somebody that's not the three of us says it and is doing this in a professional setting. Because we certainly preached this, but thank you.
Are you saying we're not professional, Amy?
yeah, we'll take the fifth on that. Well, that's interesting. How are you planning on incorporating kind of the Twitter audience, or how do you incorporate the Twitter audience into the publication as you move forward, Susan?
Well, you know what? I think that is my biggest challenge, probably, is to try to get some of the Twitter action to come over to our site.
Oh,
because we get a lot of our writers are already, you know, they write for us and then they tweet it out. And then there's this whole big conversation going on in Twitter about their article. And I'll say, gee, could you come back and comment on the site? And they kind of get offended because they say, well, I'm being social. I'm promoting it via social media. And they don't seem to get that, well, I want some, you know, conversation going on the website also. So that is what we would like for Network Computing and for UBM, is to get some of that interaction going on in our space. But for the industry, everyone is so comfortable in Twitter that to move any of that over is going to be a big deal, I think.
Twitter so owns that second layer, that meta conversation, that comment layer, that they would practically have to ban cat pictures and videos before people would abandon the platform.
It's tough. I mean, in some ways, we all fight against that. All the bloggers have noticed it. It's not 2005 anymore. And even on our community site, VMware's community site, founded in 2002, up and to the right the whole time, you know, growing 100% a year. We noticed as soon as Twitter started in 2007, our people maybe got on 8, the curve flattened. And a lot of the chit-chat that was happening even on our forum site moved to Twitter. Blogs these days, it's tough. You can get a thread go, and so this is what you're battling against, Susan. You know, it's just right. a canonical or a secular shift that's happened. I wrote a blog post this afternoon on why webinars suck, and it's actually a great idea. Yeah. It's either great or it's brilliant or terrible. I'm not quite sure which is that you should put all sorts of other digital toys in front of people while they watch your boring webinar so that you can watch them, you know,
actually
read more of your stuff.
Yeah.
Well, they're going to surf anyway, so they might as well surf your white paper instead of
webinar for ADD.
Exactly. Yeah. It really is.
And Susan, I'm one of those tech people that, yeah, if you ask me to kind of, you know, move from where I'm comfortable in mid conversation and like go help you with your metrics, I'm inclined to put myself in those people's shoes that would be more offended, being like, I don't really care that you want to capture my ideas on your webpage. I mean,
I don't have time for this.
Well, like, even if I do, like, I kind of just don't care that you care about it. Like, no offense to you. Like, who are you to me? If we have a relationship, like, now that I know you, and if you ask me to go write on a webpage instead of posting to Twitter, I would in a heartbeat. So it only makes it more important for you to be somebody who's engaged with individuals and has the credibility and sway to bring them into a conversation. And then your platform better be freaking wonderful, because it's hard enough to get them off there. If you bring them to like the junkyard of platforms, you're dead.
Well, I'm thinking about John's point about ADD for webinars. In some ways, the same thing applies, right? Blog comments, YouTube comments, let's not even go there, but blog comments are focused, blinders on a little bit. If they meander, you're scolded. Even within a community environment, if they meander, you're scolded. But on Twitter, you're encouraged to have a lively actual content debate at the same time that you Instagram your breakfast and send out 3 cat pictures. I mean, it really encourages that kind of frenetic activity. So anyway, just an observation. Right. I hadn't thought about it.
Well, and that actually was not my point, see, because we all have ADD here. My point was I wrote a blog post this afternoon, and I got 0 comments, but I got about 15 tweet replies. So, problem is, these are the people I'm very engaged with, but they didn't come over to my blog and talk.
But John, why do you care?
Oh, Twitter is really crappy for conversations, right? I have longer replies to them, but I can't really do it on Twitter. Twitter is bad. It's good for like one or two back and forths, but and that's I think why Google Plus is taking off a little bit in our space, just because you can actually have a conversation.
But I think that's also why I end up texting people. I end up having DM conversations that have maxed out the amount of DMs I can send in a day. It's I have a whole kind of fascination with if it drives the conversation private, because in a world where we are frenetic and have ADD and we need to focus, we'll focus on a quote unquote private conversation through these mediums. Mm-hmm. That's a blog post for another day. But
yeah, but John, I suppose, yeah, it is a little awkward that people are all tweeting you. You have a longer comment, so you go write it on another platform and say, hey, go look at it here.
It's where we are. You know, it is what it is. I'm curious, Susan, so if somebody wanted to get – are you looking for writers? And if somebody wanted to start writing for you, if they were one of these, you know, IT technical influencer folks and found that your topic area was interesting, you know, how would they go about that, and kind of what are you looking for?
Yes, we're always looking for new writers. So anyone who has any writing experience, who knows about the technology, is welcome to contact me. They can tweet at me or email me or call me. Like on LinkedIn, all of my information is exposed, I believe. So they can just get in touch with me and we'll take it from there. Mm-hmm.
In terms of so just writing experience, if I have a blog and I've been blogging about stuff, I mean, that's enough to at least start the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nice.
And that's where I am still very fascinated with that. How much time somebody needs to invest in developing their community reputation versus really focus on the content, really just sit down, you know, seat time, just write.
Meaning you still need the seat time, you're saying.
Well, I'm curious, Susan, what if there's a hard, fast rule, if there's guidance you could offer people who are interested, is it if they want to develop their craft, how would you direct them in this modern age?
Oh, that's tough. I think the more you can write, like if you have a blog, the more time you devote to it, the better off you are. Any writing that you do and the better you can get at it is going to help you.
Makes sense. I think I just write, keep writing. I mean, that's usually every writer's advice to all aspiring writers, right? Keep writing.
Yeah, exactly.
Start writing, keep writing. So, Susan, sometimes we actually do give advice to actual people engaged in acts of marketing, since many of us work in that area too.
Even as we deny that we engage them ourselves. I think I'm guilty of that tonight.
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever. I never was a marketer. You can't prove it.
Can't prove a thing. I have pictures, Matt. I have pictures. But Susan, how would you? And so some of our advice is, you know, how to from a vendor marketing perspective, how to work with influencers and things like that. How do you like, if I'm in a vendor marketing, and obviously this is PR's job, is to work with you usually. Is that one? Is that changing now that you also have influencers going on? Because like, you know, our friend Joe works for Cisco. Is PR involved in that relationship? Can they, if I'm a vendor marketing role, is there any way I can talk to you directly? Is that a big no? Oh my goodness! That might explode the world, right? If I talk to you without PR involved, because traditionally PR would be the person talking to you. How do you see that all evolving? Or what's the current situation even?
Yeah, it would be helpful if PR could facilitate some of those conversations sometimes, because they don't usually. If anything, they kind of try to keep you from talking to the technologists in the organization because they're afraid of what they're going to tell you. I usually use PR is helpful for getting me in contact with people who can help me learn about new things that are coming out or new developments or launches. As far as the agreed upon message, but not as far as deep technology or, you know, whatever is going on with customers or, you know, the interesting things that readers really want to know about. If they could give me access to some of the people who are a little bit deeper in the organization, that would be helpful.
Right. Well, that's the trick of what I just said, right? What if those people reached out directly to you?
Yeah, sure. And sometimes they do. Mm-hmm.
But John, something we haven't really hit on that I feel we might have almost assumed just out of practice here, that we haven't really discussed what part of someone's persona is going to benefit from that. Is it their work persona? That they're doing this in order to gain some sort of market share as part of their evangelist tasks of their job, or is this really primarily something for your private persona that you've detached from your work one and you're building that reputation and personal brand separately?
Yeah, I guess I'm really talking about two separate scenarios, and it's kind of dangerous when they cross sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's where the fascination comes from, right? That it is dangerous when you don't know what your goal is. Are you trying to build up something? Are you bringing PR in because this is an opportunity for you, or are you bringing PR in because you want them to facilitate something that's going to be like a interesting behind the scenes of a customer case story for your business? And like both of those could be very attractive to Susan and to their audience and their community. But if you don't know which one you're going at when you're reaching out to her, you're going to be pretty dead in the water. And best practices still apply. Like, you know, get that head coverage of having somebody higher up in your food chain that knows what you're doing, that you've kind of gut checked with, even if you haven't gotten their permission. But at least you have somebody watching out for you.
Susan, have you ever given Amy coined this term citizen analyst, and so let's also in as a back formation from citizen journalists, but maybe here we're talking about citizen tech journalists, bloggers, if you for short. Have you ever had any issues? I find with ethics, I find that ethical issues rarely come up. Everyone's usually working in good faith, but are you more concerned with bloggers in terms of either influence or trying to push something, a tech agenda on you to your publication?
No, I haven't really run into that. The only trouble we have sometimes is the vendor's perception of what the blogger is saying. You know, they are not happy with some criticism or whatever. But that happens with journalists and any kind of writer. So it's not particular to citizen analysts or citizen tech analysts.
The lower the stake, you know, lower the stakes, the less I see ethics problems, right? In the blogosphere, I don't see a huge – I mean, some vendors we like to we like to take – you know, I give you free tickets. I'll take you out to dinner. Hopefully you disclose all that, but I don't see a huge amount of like, you know, underground agendas or things like that. You know, we'll have to have our sometimes some analysts get tarred with that, but I don't want to paint all analysts as bad.
Great. Well, Susan, it's been wonderful to speak with you, and we're happy to have you as a listener. And let this be a warning to all our other listeners. If you have an interesting topic and you're willing to jump on, we are happy to have you and discuss more with you. So keep listening and see you next time.
You've been listening to the Geek Whisperers podcast, where we bring social media and community to enterprise IT. You can listen to all the episodes at our website, geek-whisperers.com, or check us out on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. Your hosts were John Mark Troyer, Amy Lewis, and Matthew Brender, better known on Twitter as J. Troyer, Comms Ninja, and MJ Brender. See you next week.
That would leave me, but I feel like I don't know Susan very well.
None of us know Susan. We've just meeting her. Hi, Susan. We're very friendly. We're not very organized.
Do you want me to lead off?
That would be awesome. We've done that.
Make up a little theme song.
You're back with the Geek Whisperers. No, okay. I'll read.